Hey, deserving listeners, this is part three in my audio version of me reacting to a therapy session on YouTube with Andrew Tate. Let's watch.
Ask yourself a question, like what would happen if you let go of trying to control everything? Just feel into what that would feel like.
But that goes back to the point about what vulnerability is, because I don't think humans are as emotionally incontinent as they pretend to be. And I believe that when you truly feel pain or truly...
Emotionally incontinent. So I think he's saying, I believe that true humans or better humans don't leak their emotions as often as they...
You feel trauma or something really bad happens to you, the result to that is usually silence. I don't think you talk very much at all. So people, you ask me, what is it like to be vulnerable? Well, to me, that's not crying. That's not... I think when anyone's doing that, 99% of the time, it's a manipulation tactic.
He's still spouting his ridiculous notions about emotion. I don't need to point out how ridiculous it is. It's a reflection of society. Andrew Tate is a reflection of society. He did not emerge out of nowhere. He is a product of our misogynistic, sexist society. It might look like, I was about to say he's an exaggeration, but he isn't really. There are plenty of people of various genders who are worse than him, but they don't have a YouTube channel. They just live their lives and harm themselves and other people. So he's not unique in that way. He's unique or somewhat rare in that he seemingly isn't afraid to lean into it and to talk about it. So I don't know why I'm saying that. I'm saying that because I want everyone to reminding myself, and we can all remind ourselves that, we can attack Andrew Tate. We might even be able to get him in prison or cancel him or whatever. That does not solve the problem. We have a massive problem. Why does anyone respect him? Why does anyone think he's a genius? That's not because Andrew Tate somehow coerced everyone into believing his nonsense. It's because we as a society had already been telling young boys these notions subtly and not so subtly, and also telling them that they can't have those points of view, which is a good thing, but we injected them with the feelings and the notions and the ideas and the oppressive ideologies to begin with, and then attacked them. And then Andrew Tate comes along and starts spouting it and doesn't seem to be afraid of it, and so people flock to him. It's all of our fault. It's society's fault. So we can get rid of Andrew Tate, but we're not going to get rid of the problem.
I believe, personally. Maybe that's just my personal experience.
But
maybe. But I think especially with men, I think it's a manipulation tactic when they try and show too much emotion. And women do it as well. And I don't react very well to it. If someone were to sit in front of me and start bawling their eyes out, it's very hard to elicit sympathy from me for that reason. I feel like you get sympathy from me by sitting and explaining to me why something bad happened to you in a logical, calm, stoic manner. If someone starts crying in front of me, I feel like they're trying to manipulate me and I don't buy it.
Or maybe you judge it in them because you judge that in yourself.
Perhaps. I mean, it's my human experience.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time praising David knowing what I now know about him. But yeah, that was a very concise therapy thing to say. And it was great that Andrew agreed. I don't know how much he actually agrees, but he's at least allowing for it to happen. And David said essentially what he's saying is something that I would think or say, which is, okay, when anyone cries in front of you, you judge them and you have concluded that they're weak or something and they're manipulating you. And what is probably actually happening is that you're judging yourself for having emotions. And when other people are expressing emotions, normally you're through projective identification or projection, you're actually judging them, but really you're judging yourself. And it probably comes from when you were childhood. David said something earlier. It's like, was your mom emotionally manipulative? And that would never be a question that I would ask, because emotionally manipulative, I find those phrases to be extremely reductionistic and simplistic. On TikTok and on the internet, you'll hear these phrases, this person is emotionally manipulative. Once people describe what they're referring to when they say emotionally manipulative, it's across the board. There are so many different scenarios that I would call other sorts of things. And so I wouldn't ask that question. I would say something like, well, how were emotions dealt with in your family growing up? How did your dad express emotion? How did he react to you when you had emotion? How did your dad react to your brother or to your mom with emotion? And, you know, everyone.
Experience, right? Right. And it's my bias.
Right.
But I'm trying to think of the very few scenarios in which I would ever cry. And I'm thinking, would it genuinely be because I feel so much pain, or if I think it could benefit me or help me? Well, would I be trying to manipulate somebody? Now, that's not something I'd ever do because it's not my personality and mental frame. But
crying is just a physiological reaction to express pain and grief that allows us to release this and to come back to home.
I don't understand how David and I could think so similarly and yet think so differently. It's such a weird contradiction. But of course, you know, thinking like Andrew Tate doesn't mean that you can't. Although it is weird that David is saying some very familiar things to me. And it's not me, it's just a lot of therapists and others would think this way. David's not, and I'm not unique in this way, but it's weird that he could be, I think, right, or at least in my ballpark philosophically about emotion and a lot of things about therapy, seemingly from the little bit that I've seen, but also believe that women are inherently illogical and that anyone attack, I don't know if I show this clip, but they were basically saying that anyone attacking Andrew Tate was jealous. They were both agreeing that anyone who criticizes Andrew Tate is jealous of him. You know, any man who criticizes is jealous. Any woman who criticizes is both jealous and they want to sleep with him. And I'm just thinking, no, I mean, maybe, but I criticize Andrew Tate. I don't want to sleep with him and I'm not jealous of him. At all. There's nothing about his life. I mean, if someone wants his lifestyle, okay, but there's nothing about his lifestyle that I envy in the least. You couldn't pay me enough money to live the kind of life that, even the little bits that I've seen about his life, it's just completely against what I value and what I would want in my life day to day. Anyway, the reason why I criticize him is because the ideas that he has are not unique to him. They are old, old ideas about gender and emotion and humanness that are harmful to humans, including Andrew Tate and everyone else who follows him. I imagine there are probably some things in Andrew Tate. I've already heard some things from Andrew Tate, even in this, that I thought, well, that could be a good thing to tell other people to think this way, to reframe things or whatever. But so I'm not saying everything he says like this, but there are some things that he says that are harmful to everyone, including Andrew Tate. Andrew Tate's perspective, I am 99.9% sure, harms him perhaps even more than it harms other people. Because for him, even in this one tiny example of his perspective where he thinks that emotions are weak and manipulative, and he's even saying for himself, I don't show emotion or I don't have emotion or something. The amount of damage that is having on his personality and on his relationships is tremendous. Even if he's a psychopath, even if you believe he's a psychopath. I've worked with psychopaths and part of helping them to manage their behavior is to manage their emotions. And part of managing their emotions is for them to allow themselves to have healthy expressions of emotions. So even if he's a psychopath, but regardless, anyone with any sort of issue or disorder to say to themselves, all emotion is manipulative, is not only harmful to other people because they judge others, but it's just harmful to themselves. So that's why I'm criticizing him, not because I'm jealous of him or I want him to go away necessarily. I just want everyone, his followers, everyone who knows about him, himself included, I have compassion for humans and I would just want everyone to allow themselves to be human.
Homeostasis.
It's like, manipulation. It's
just, well it can be.
It's don't attack me
but
anymore.
But it's also a physiological response.
Oh, completely. But it's don't attack me anymore. It's I'm the victim, don't attack
me
anymore.
It can be.
Yes, I cheated on you. It's a shield. And so when we talk about what does vulnerable mean, I feel like...
Interesting that his one example of crying is when someone cheats and then is caught. That's the only example that he can come up with in which is someone might cry.
I'm being vulnerable now when I'm explaining things extremely logically.
You are.
That's as vulnerable as I can be.
It's not logical. It is logical to acknowledge emotion because that is scientifically and biologically relevant and coherent to acknowledge emotion. Emotions are a part of reality. This notion that logic is the opposite of emotion, you know, like with Star Trek and, you know, Vulcans and Data, so that's not the way humans operate. It is logical to be emotional. When a friend of mine were to call me a bad name or to insult me and I feel hurt, it is logical that I feel hurt. When I am watching Step Brothers with Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, and I'm laughing, that is an emotion of laughter and joy and enjoyment. It is logical that I feel that emotion. It would be illogical for me to shut down the emotion or to deny the emotion. It is logical to feel emotions.
Not be the kind of person who's gonna cry. But once again, this is my mental model. I haven't instilled.
But is that what it means? Vulnerability, cry?
I guess vulnerability.
What about admitting your weaknesses?
I'll admit my weaknesses
right
now.
What are your weaknesses?
Okay. So it's interesting that he would even say that. Well, of course he would, because he has to give this notion that he's in control of everything. And I think he knows that it would be illogical or a sign of weakness that he can't recognize that he has weaknesses. But he's really in a bind here, I'm guessing. Backed into a corner. He backed himself into the corner. So let's see how he digs himself out.
Then this is so interesting, because I will tell you. No, it is, because I'll tell.
So I interpret that, what we just saw, and I'll rewind it, as his brain glitching because he wants to be a part of his relationship with David. He respects David enough and allows David to influence him enough to introduce the idea that he has weaknesses. And then he's like, okay, I have weaknesses. And then okay, what are they? And then he glitched because that defense, he can't tolerate even the thought of thinking about his weaknesses, let alone saying them. Let's rewatch.
That's vulnerability.
What about admitting your weaknesses?
I'll admit my weaknesses
right
now.
What are your weaknesses?
Then this is so interesting, because I will tell you. No, it is, because I'll tell
you. See, the gears turning. It's interesting to see. And just to demonstrate, I have a lot of weaknesses. One weakness is that I talk too much with my wife. I yammer too much. I explain things too much. My stories are too long. It's a weakness. I'm bothering other people. I don't notice, or I put too many words in this. You know, some of you might even think this about me in these videos. It's like, Kirk, just get to the point. And it's a weakness, absolutely a weakness. I have many other weaknesses. So the reason why I'm saying this right now is because I want to demonstrate how easy it is for people who have been through a lot of therapy or who have been raised well and or who have been raised well to very quickly admit that they have a weakness. It's human to have weaknesses. It's normal. It's okay. I'm not ashamed of it. I feel guilty. I feel bad. I'm working on it. I have worked on it. But I still do it. And I feel bad. I'm trying not to. And that's a weakness. It's not only a weakness I have it, it's a weakness that I can't fix it, that I can't change it. It's, you know, it's a lot of weaknesses involved. It's not hard to admit that you have weaknesses.
Tell you I'll admit my weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I will. Mm-hmm. But now I have to try and identify some, because in my mental framework, I don't have weaknesses.
Right.
So now it's like, okay, I am prepared to admit where I'm weak. Where am I weak? Well, I've tried so hard for so long to make sure I'm not weak anywhere. And if I am, I've compensated so heavily in some other way.
It's interesting to see him run in circles around this. I think there's a part of him that knows he should talk about his weaknesses, or that it would be healthy for him. Has that look to it? Because he talks a lot, and that's what he does for a living. And so he undoubtedly has 1,000 things he could say right now to change the subject or to frame it in his shtick. But he's not doing that. He is, but he's lingering in the zone that he might have weaknesses. So I think there's a part of him that's like, I think I should. And then he's talking about the barriers. He's saying, well, I can't really talk about weaknesses because my whole thing is to deny my weaknesses. He's not saying it directly, but basically what he's saying, it's interesting. And, you know, maybe I'll do an intro at the beginning of this to kind of set the stage, which I don't normally do because I usually just start it up and react, but I might put this at the beginning and say something like, the purpose of these videos that I'm making is a way for us to understand ourselves and people like both of these individuals, people like David, people like Andrew Tate. Instead of just, you know, because we can cancel or jail Andrew Tate, but you might have someone in your life like this. You might have a child. You know, one of your teens might be like him. You might have a spouse. You might be kind of like this, or you might have tendencies in this direction. So that's the benefit of us evaluating this, really, and looking at it and wondering how we can help people like this and figuring it out instead of just saying like, oh, Andrew Tate, cancel, which we could do. But, you know, again, people in our lives, we might not be able to do that. So we want to understand it. Where does it come from and what are the roads to wellness?
Fail. So it was like, where am I weak? I'm that guy who does not fail. It doesn't matter what scenario anybody's life is in. It doesn't matter if you get dumped into jail. It doesn't matter if you're going into war. It doesn't matter if you're bankrupt, whatever it is. If someone says Tate's on your side, you feel good. Oh, Tate's here. Ah, Tate. Okay.
Yeah.
He can't even swim, but he's here to he's the lifeguard. Tate doesn't fail. I can swim, but it's an example.
It's an interesting metaphor. And, you know, he said a few things about people depending on him, you know, within his misogynistic framework about how all these women depend on him and all these kids depend on him. And at first I thought he was talking about kids like the internet, which he also talks about, but I think he might also be talking about his own offspring. I don't know. But he seems to have kind of a complex about that dependency. I think he wants to be depended on, but has a complicated relationship with that. And then his metaphor is, or what he's saying is like, everyone understands that when Andrew Tate is here, they're comforted. And I have to say, I think most people would not, if they knew anything about him, would not be like, oh, hallelujah, Andrew Tate is on the scene. He's going to solve all of our problems. I just can't imagine that being what people would think. But that's his point of view, and you know, maybe he's experienced that in his life. But there's a theme that I'm hearing in which it's him taking care of other people and kind of resenting it, and that's his purpose. Maybe that's his usefulness, and that actually could play into his whole content provision in that he maybe ventured into content making as with a little bit of misogyny, but then a lot of the boys and men who are looking for some kind of answer, some way out of the woods, since they've already been indoctrinated into misogyny, he actually morphed himself. You know, I think Donald Trump kind of did this as well, because throughout his life, he has drastically changed his political views and other kinds of views. And for people, they might come across like they're very sure of themselves and they have everything figured out, but they actually deep down might actually be just morphing who they are to feel useful to other people. And that's how they gain their sense of security, is that people need them. And so there seems to be a theme around that for him. I wonder about his childhood in that respect of overfunctioning, codependency, of parentification. His dad was, it sounds like, at least prone to anger, maybe temper, maybe abuse. At the very least, was scary to him. And he at least has one brother, I think a twin brother, I'm not sure. So who knows? But it's possible that at some point people came to him, maybe even his own mom came to him, maybe even his own dad when they were young, when Andrew Tate was young. And he has that as part of his pathway to safety and security, is my way to feel like I can sleep at night is if people think that I'm useful. And it's also wrapped up in his other parts of his personality. Because, you know, narcissistic individuals aren't necessarily overfunctioners, but they can be. So it just makes me wonder.
I do not fail ever. So it's very hard for me to identify weaknesses, because I feel like they've all been ruthlessly, I think I've rooted out any weakness, or I've compensated so heavily so long ago. I don't.
So he's worked his way back to the narcissistic defensive structure, that he doesn't fail, that he has never made a mistake, and you know, he doesn't have any weaknesses. Remember, this all started with him acknowledging, I have weaknesses. Okay, what are they? And now we're here. And this is just run-of-the-mill therapy. I've been in so many conversations and sessions with clients that are on the narcissistic spectrum, whether it's actual narcissism, you know, narcissistic personality, or they're immature or undifferentiated or particularly lacking in awareness, or they have psychopathy or some other, there's a lot of personality disorders that can result in this, but you know, regardless of the exact conceptualization or label, I've been in this position a lot of times where I can manage to get someone to admit to themselves that they have vulnerability, that they have weaknesses, and giving me an opportunity to provide them a corrective experience by saying, like, it's okay that you have this and you're still a good person. There's nothing to be ashamed of. That's what I'm hoping for. But they don't give me that opportunity, and they very quickly, so they kind of, you know, they kind of admit something, but then they very quickly get to a place where I'm seeing the defensive structure emerge. And the way that this is presenting, I think him admitting that he has weaknesses and him, when his gears were turning, having to actually maybe even glimpse some of his weaknesses, maybe some of his weaknesses emerged in that moment slightly. And it was so threatening to him that he very quick, you know, that mode of his very quickly kicked in. And we hear this sort of exaggerated, I'm perfect and superior language.
I see myself as a weak person. I don't see myself as a person who can fail. People said to me in jail, how did you handle that? What else can I do? Not handle it? What does that look like? I'm gonna bang my head on the wall like a dummy? Am I gonna have a breakdown and just be a pile of mush? All you can do is handle it. So you were talking about vulnerability. I'm being as vulnerable as I can, but I can't even honestly sit here and tell you a weakness I have, because in my mind I have no weaknesses. And perhaps that's delusion. Perhaps that's perhaps.
So the way that it's interesting, this video is giving me an opportunity to think and talk about things that I don't think I've ever talked about on this channel before. There's a lot of experiences as a therapist that you acquire that you might not actually ever have a chance to articulate or be reminded of to even talk about when you're even talking with consultants or whatnot. So this moment reminds me of something that happens a lot in therapy, regardless of the context, where I'm working real hard. Therapy can often be a wrestling match, a struggle. One way to frame it is I'm actually trying to ally myself with their humanness and the healthy part of them, but this defensive mode will kick in. So me and their healthy side are wrestling with their defenses is one way to think about it, and manage to get the client or to help them to admit that they are human, to allow that healthy part of them come out for a second. And then very quickly, the defense starts to kick in, but it's a ramp up. And then eventually it's really exaggerated. But then what Andrew Tate did was he sort of surmounted the hill and said, okay, I'm back to normal. I've established that I'm superior. I never make mistakes. I've never failed. I'm awesome. I just rattled off a bunch of things that, you know, are convincing at least myself that I'm superior. I've established that in my mind. And you can almost consider that he's saying this to reassure. I've never failed. I don't have weaknesses. Because I don't think David believes that. And so he's saying it. And once he gets over the hill, he can kind of take a break because he was terrified earlier and look around and think, oh, wait, we were talking about my weaknesses. And then he can kind of, you know, the fact that David allowed him to go in that direction, because it'd be tempting for David in the therapist role to say, oh, you're doing it, you know, and, you know, maybe down the road you might be able to have the rapport enough to do that. But David lets him reestablish the narcissistic structure, and then he can breathe and then return eventually to the topic at hand, which is that he has weaknesses. So he's like barely allowing himself to express that, but very quickly saying, but I have a system in which I don't allow myself to have weaknesses. But he's kind of admitting very, very slightly that he has a weakness. You know, that's his healthy human inner child just barely able to sneak through the defense.
Want to give your sons more quality time than you had with your father?
I'll give them the exact same amount as he gave me.
Will you?
But if I'm happy with
Would you not want to give them more?
I may want to.
You wanted more.
I didn't say I wanted more. Oh. That's smart. I didn't say I wanted more.
You didn't?
Yeah, no.
You must have.
No, I'm saying that.
Boy wants time with his daddy. How can, I mean, it has to be true.
Yeah, so they've been talking for a long time about various different things. Most of it was just Andrew Tate resorting to his defensive structure that he's perfect and everything's fine and bragging. But David just caught him on the possibility that Andrew Tate did lament not getting more attention from his dad because of things that he talked about regarding his dad. And Andrew Tate is defending, oh, you're being tricky with that. And so let's see how the rest of this goes.
More?
I may want to.
You wanted more.
I didn't say I wanted more.
I didn't even notice it the first time. He almost seemingly admitted that, yeah, I did want more attention from my dad. He almost said it, and then he caught himself. Let's rewatch that.
Want to give them more?
I may want to.
You wanted more.
I didn't say I wanted more. That's smart.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, I don't know. Maybe behind the camera, you know, away from the cameras, Andrew Tate can somewhat admit that he is sad or laments that pain and that neglect that he went through as a kid. But on camera, he's selling a certain thing. And so he puts on a public persona. Who knows? But at least the version that we're seeing in front of the camera, that's a good representation of someone that will have, David is pretty good at, and I don't understand why Andrew Tate even likes David the way that, I guess because David has proven himself to be a true misogynist, more of a misogynist than he is in some ways. So Andrew Tate is, also it has, and I've run into this before as well, that it's possible that Andrew Tate is much more likely to respect men, which of course makes sense, and might even have a completely different approach when he's talking to men, particularly men that he might respect. I don't know if it's because David has had success in Hollywood or because he's a professional or so, I don't know. But I've run into this before and used it to my benefit where a teen or an adult will, you know, often men who are misogynistic will treat women therapists very poorly. And it'll be determined that, well, maybe this client would do better with a male therapist, and they get referred to me, and then I find that they're not disrespectful to me at all. In fact, they're quite deferential to me, and so you know you can see that happening. Sometimes it would even happen in the same room, like if I was working with a school, and a student was, you know, the student isn't my client, but I'm tasked with some sort of psychological job, and the teenager is disrespecting a woman teacher, and then I come on the scene and suddenly they're much more deferential and obedient to me. And so sometimes we can kind of use that, and you know, it can kind of work vice versa, but not usually. But he is, you know, being confronted on the fact that at one point, I mean, but I've seen this, you know, with insecure teenagers, with insecure adults, they will do stuff like this notion of like, yeah, my dad neglected me, but I'm totally fine, you know. And I might say, you know, maybe you were hurt back then. And no, I was never hurt. I was totally fine. That's almost more the norm than not, honestly. So Andrew Tate isn't doing anything unusual here, but it does illuminate, I think, an insecurity.
Say I wanted more.
You didn't?
Yeah, no.
You must have.
No, I'm saying that
he wants time with his daddy. It has to be true.
If I wanted, I could have earned it anytime I wanted.
The way Andrew Tate said that, I don't think he believes it. I think he's grasping at straws. Let's rewatch that.
I mean, it has to be true.
If I wanted, I could have earned it anytime I wanted.
Yeah, I think David has broken him down over an hour and 53 minutes such that he's grasping at straws. And I don't even think Andrew Tate believes what he's saying right now. Or maybe the pain is sneaking through or something. Or the fact that he almost said, of course I wanted more attention from my dad. Like that feeling emerged into his consciousness. I think it might be affecting him.
Well, are you sure about that?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I don't know if we need to read the tweet, but it's like, your mom was pretty upset with him. So he was like, I'm not coming back here. I mean, it wasn't just about you, it was about your mother.
Oh, completely. And I think my father sacrificed his marriage for us boys. Mm-hmm. He sacrificed his marriage and his relationship with my mother to ensure that us boys were taught the way he believed we should be raised. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I don't know if I'm reading this right, but it sounds like there was conflict in his parents, in their marriage, and a fair amount of neglect. And who knows what was going on with his mom. Not that there's something nefarious, but there's always something going on with every parent. If you're a parent, there's something going on with you. So, because we all have weaknesses, we all have issues, we all have traumas. Anyway, so what we're hearing is that there was a lot of conflict, a lot of potential, at least, abandonment, neglect happening for Andrew Tate, which I wouldn't be surprised by. And at some point, the dad, it sounds like maybe the, who knows, but it sounds like maybe the parents were arguing about how to raise their kids. And maybe misogyny, or at least misogyny-esque notions, were a part of it, that the dad was like, no, we need to make... So it's very common, as I'm sort of working myself through this, it's very common for this to be a fight among parents. It's almost impossible to find two parents that have the identical sense of when to put your foot down and when not to, when to discipline, when not to, what sort of discipline. It's almost impossible to find two parents that are exactly the same. In fact, it's common for parents to be, you know, significantly different. Both parents might be in the healthy zone. This is what I would say. If a parent was outside the healthy zone, then I would say that. But a lot of parents, both of them would be within the healthy zone, but they're just different. And they're calling the other one wrong and outside the healthy zone. But both of them are probably okay. They don't need to compromise necessarily. They could do this sometimes. They could do this sometimes. But it's common for parents to disagree, and sometimes they can disagree in really profound ways, and it can also undermine the marriage and cause conflict, especially if they don't have a very strong bond. So it's common enough of a profile where you have a heterosexual marriage with, you know, with kids, and the father will be more of a disciplinarian than the mother. It doesn't always fall that way. That's a stereotype. I've seen the reverse. I've seen nuances to it, but it's possible that that was going on with Andrew Tate, and the dad was neglectful, but when he was around, then he's saying, oh, you got to get those kids in line. I don't know. I'm just making up a story. Who knows? And then at some point, the father, maybe throughout Andrew Tate. So if this is true, which I have no idea, it's possible that Andrew Tate is looking at his parents and wanting them to get along, and he desperately wants a relationship with both. He probably has enough of a relationship with his mom that he can feel okay with that. He doesn't have enough of a relationship with his dad. This is a common scenario, such that he idolizes his dad, you know, the Disneyland dad syndrome. And when dad comes around, he can do no wrong. And then dad disappears for a while and he makes all these excuses, because children, one of the ways they can cope with this scenario is to just split all the good and the bad into different camps. They identify with the good, because if they let the bad in, it destroys the good. And if that happens, then they're truly demoralized. They're like, because if they let the bad in, if they acknowledge the bad, then they have to question if their dad even loves them or loves them enough. So it's safer and easier, and a really terrible position that people will put children in sometimes. And so they'll idolize dad. Anything bad becomes split off. It gets internalized by the child, but it gets split off, to the point sometimes where the child will split it off and blame it on the parent that's been around more, on the mom, and say, you're abandoning me. And the mom's like, what are you talking about? Like, your dad can do no wrong. I'm here. I'm abandoning. What is happening? But the child is, they're struggling and they don't know what to do, right? They're trying to preserve what they have. They also want to please their dad, so their dad will come around a little bit more often, or at least it won't jeopardize the little thread of connection that they have. And it's possible, again, I'm just making up a story, that if this is anywhere near the mark, that the dad also was misogynistic. That's ridiculous, because everyone has misogyny inside of them. But maybe particularly sexist or something. Maybe because of the conflict. Again, I'm just making up stories. But the dad developed notions of like, well, you know, women, you know, it's not uncommon to hear that sort of thing. And then Andrew Tate's just like worshiping at the feet of his father. His father is struggling and is spouting all this stuff. Might even be trying to win Andrew Tate's loyalty over by saying, you know, don't listen to your mom. Women are lesser and whatever. I don't know. Who knows? Just a lot of different what ifs. And to this day, Andrew Tate is seeking non-abandonment and acceptance from his father by trying to drastically and exaggeratedly prove that he is massively sexist and hates mom. And he's in this continuous loop of just running on that treadmill of, you know, just keep it up. And one day I will arrive at the promised land where dad will finally love me and accept me and be there for me.
My mom was very unhappy with certain things he did, which he insisted on doing anyway, because he saw his legacy in us as more important than his marriage with my mother. But I'm not saying, look, if my son calls me and says, I'm really upset, I need to talk to you, I'm not gonna say, no, you can't talk to me. I'm not psycho, right? I understand all of these things. I'm just saying, in obviously we're talking about a very general scenario. The general scenario is, I'm a man, I'm away at war, I come home with a story, or if I'm spending time with my son, I want us to be building him as an individual.
And then it sounds like the transgenerational trauma is continuing, and it sounds like he's neglecting his kids. I don't know, but that's the way it kind of sounds like, right?
I already know the answer.
And you already know the answer.
Of course, only love can win.
Yeah.
Only love can win.
Yeah.
And it's the most powerful driving force on the face of the planet. It always has been. Mm-hmm. And it's only when people are going to wake up and have a true love for themselves and love for their community and love for their children and love for these things that we're going to start to resist the evil, mm-hmm, and the Satanism and the insanity which is coming in the world today. But I believe, as a man at least, your love only has value when you're capable, which is why I'm so obsessed with capability, because I want my love to have value. We talked about how time has value when you're...
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. So that's in line with what I was talking about earlier regarding this connection between usefulness and safety within relationships and attachment. He very explicitly is saying just that. He's saying that the only way in which my love, and it's very interesting that David was able to get Andrew Tate off of his typical defensiveness and that zone that he gets into talking about love just as a topic in general. Andrew Tate is still pontificating and very sure of himself about his perspective, but at the very least, the topic of love and connection is an acceptable topic for Andrew in this situation. But he's very explicitly saying, in order for my love to my family to be worth anything, meaning that for people to value my love, not my definition of my value of my love, but in order for my love to be acceptable, I need to be competent. I need to be successful. I need to be superior. I need to achieve I need to constantly achieve things. I need to show how valuable I am. If I have 40 sports cars, then my love is more valuable, right? Right, mommy? Right, daddy? That kind of thing. And that is very interesting that he was able to say that. And it sheds light on his compulsions and his perspective, the kinds of things that he involves himself in, and the behaviors that he engages in, and the pontificating and the bragging. The look at me, I have 40 sports cars. I don't know how many times he's mentioned that. I'm successful. People think I'm great. I have this many downloads, da da da. Will you accept me, and will you accept my love? Am I worthy of your am I worthy to love you? is something that I've treated people for before, that I will provide corrective experiences around an awareness that their love is worthy in and of itself. They could be the most unsuccessful person on the planet, and their love is still valuable. In fact, to be successful and to be obsessed about one's success interferes with your ability to love. Because they're kind of in the zone where they're still talking about parenting. And I think what he's saying is, in order for my love to have worth to my, I think it's former spouses and to my kids, he keeps referring to how he has multiple sons. It sounds like some of them are quite young. In order for my love to have value, I need to be successful. That's what my dad taught me, is what he's saying. That's how my dad lived, which is also interesting because you can imagine a young Andrew Tate being neglected by his father, who works all the time, or at least that's the perception. That's the excuse that the dad has, or whatever. Maybe the dad did work a lot. And Andrew Tate is like, okay, if I look at it one way, he doesn't really love me, and I'm not worthy of love. Those two things are two of the most painful things to a child to conclude. Or I can believe that his love is even more valuable because he works. Yeah, that's what I'll tell myself. His love has more value because my dad actually is successful, because he has a lot of different irons in the fire and a lot of people wanting his attention. And so he can only have that if he's very successful and he starts spreading it around. Then when he does love me or pay attention to me, it's so much more valuable because of that, because it's coveted by so many people. So many people want that and need it. And if my dad was just around all the time, it would just be frivolous. You know, I'm going to tell myself that. And you might have even contrasted with, why am I obsessed with my dad when my mom's always around, or at least around more? Maybe it's because dad works a lot, and that's why. You know, you could see someone coming to that conclusion. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting that David was able to get him there. This happened a while back in August, actually. So I don't know what's happened since. Maybe he's even back in prison. I don't even know. But I wonder what'll happen. I think there's a possibility that with more conversations like this, Andrew Tate seems to want to have David in his life. So with more conversations, it's possible that Andrew Tate will start to be a little bit more healthy and thus might actually start to preach that healthiness to his followers, which would be interesting. I can't imagine that he would completely diverge from or diverge enough from his misogynistic teachings, but maybe there's a silver lining there somewhere. I don't know.
At a certain echelon, I would also argue that love has value in at a certain echelon. If I'm in love with a girl, she can get a lot more from that love than if a Joe Schmo's in love with her, yeah. Right? So my love has value because I have value.
Right. And so by contrast, what he is very much saying is, if I didn't strive and achieve and gain these markers of success, then I'm nothing. My love is nothing. That's what he's saying. Verbatim, what he's saying is, I'm great and other guys are not. And my love is great and other guys' love is not. But more fundamentally, what he's saying is, if I didn't push myself to achieve, and if I wasn't a workaholic, and he's basically been saying that he's compulsively interested in work and achievement, and he frames it like it's the way men should be, but it also sounds like he's not fully on board, like he doesn't want to work all the time, because he'll follow it up with, you know, because people depend on me. You know. But he's saying, if I didn't achieve that, my love would be worthless. That's exactly what he's saying, which I think might be at the foundation of everything that we see, or at least a lot of the things that we see.
It's interesting, yeah, because
you want me to tell you what I noticed?
Sure.
It is hard for you to stay present.
Yeah.
Right? Like you come present, and then you go to a thought, you go to an idea, and you talk, yeah. And it's very competitive.
Okay, this is interesting. So he's using a very common therapeutic technique as well. It's usually housed within humanistic or experiential, and he is trying to bring him into the here and now, both to help him know himself instead of going into an intellectual place, but also I think to be able to sit with the anxiety of being close to somebody and absorb the safety and the corrective experience such that it'll help him to be more vulnerable in the future. I think that's what he's doing.
Yeah. And you're asserting your worldview, your frame of reality, which, you know, but like sometimes like I lose you there. Yeah. Like I'm like, where are you? Like you're there's words, but I can't feel you entirely.
I understand.
You know what I mean? And I wanna like feel you more.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time praising him given what he was saying earlier that was so extremely misogynistic. He was saying that women can't be logical. He was just laughing about that. Andrew Tate even said, well, don't be that misogynistic. So I'm having a hard time with that. But this is an example of very good therapy. I don't usually see that on TV shows or on YouTube, or at least what I would consider to be my style or something. I don't do this all the time, but I have done this before, and it can be very helpful. I do versions of this all the time, but this is a specific way of doing it. And I think he's delivering it pretty well. He is convincing. He's not coming across critical. He's coming across as inviting, and he has a close enough relationship. He has good enough rapport with Andrew Tate that he's able to listen to him. And if I saw this as a supervisor, I would say this was an excellent first session, aside from the misogynistic thing that David was saying. of course, we'd have a long talk about that. But the entirety of the session is a very good early session with someone that is struggling with what seems to be a lot of trauma resulting in a defensive structure of superiority and lack and denying of one's needs and emotions, an intellectual defense. And this is a pretty powerful way to kind of wrap it up. Let's see how Andrew Tate responds.
I understand.
You know what I mean?
I understand. But I don't think...
But just stay with that. Just stay in that. Like, don't let your mind go. Just stay in the feeling. Yeah, don't go off with a thought.
So what am I feeling right now?
But just stay with me.
Okay.
Just stay with me and be present in the experience with no words and see what happens.
Yeah, it's really excellent work. If I didn't hear him say the misogynistic thing earlier, I might actually show this clip in a class or something as a way of demonstrating how to do this. You don't want to do exactly this as a therapist because then you're just doing a technique or a script. But the vibe, the emphasis, the noticing, it's very adeptly done. I think David has a talent for this because I train a lot of therapists and not everyone. It's something you can learn, but it typically means that someone had talent. Not that they could have been a therapist regardless of training, but they're perceptive and trust their instincts or use their instincts in good ways. Anyway, so I'll rewind it, but he is able to get Andrew Tate out because Andrew Tate was about to pontificate. He looked up and he's like, well, actually, and then he reeled him in. And then Andrew Tate was saying, okay, what am I feeling? And that in Andrew Tate's world is going along with what David is saying, but David also astutely said, no, stay with me right here. Because even talking about his feelings would probably cause him to go into an intellectual explainy mode. It would be less intellectual. It'd be at least intellectual about his emotions, but it would still be intellectual. And so he still, let's rewatch that.
Just stay in the feeling. Yeah, don't go off with a thought.
So what am I feeling right now?
Just stay with me.
Okay.
Just stay with me and be present in the experience with no words and see what happens.
Sure.
Like something will change in how we relate to each other. Something will soften. Like if you let yourself soften and just be with me.
Yeah.
Right? Which is kind of a weird experience for two men to have.
Yep.
Right? But it's actually what children long for with their father. It's actually what we long for is deeper levels of connection.
Yes.
Which is like,
it's pretty amazing. I that Andrew Tate is even agreeing with this. It's astonishing. I haven't watched all of Andrew Tate's material, but the stuff that I have seen, I know that someone like that is capable of this because I've worked with a lot of clients who, and I've talked about this earlier, that people like Andrew Tate are very good at convincing everyone that they don't have emotion and they're fine and they're superior. And, you know, it's easy to believe these individuals aren't really human and don't really have emotions or vulnerability. So it can be very convincing. And even for me watching Andrew Tate, I guess in the past I was, but I don't think of him as a client. If he was a client, I would be in a different headspace. But anyway, so of course he is capable of this. It's just astonishing that he was like this in front of anybody, but also in front of the camera, and they published it. The YouTube channel is Cobra Conquer. I don't even know, and I don't care to know, but I think this might even be Andrew Tate's channel. I don't even know. At any rate, he consented. Yeah, he could have shut this thing down. My point is that he was like this, and he was allowing himself to be like this in front of camera, and he allowed this to go out there. It's just kind of interesting, and I guess I have some hope for him and his followers if he continues to go down this road. Maybe. I don't know. But David is exhibiting some pretty good skill right now. And a part of, I don't know what David is thinking, but I imagine it's somewhere in this camp. For me, when I do this sort of thing, what I'm trying to do is I'm using our relationship, our therapeutic relationship, as a therapeutic tool in that he said, I'm losing connection with you when you do that, when you intellectualize. It could be communicated and received by Andrew Tate or a client in this position that, oh, you want me, you want a connection with me. You know, the client is saying, oh, my therapist wants a connection with me. And of course, I think Andrew Tate longs for that. It might even be why he even interacts with David, is because David's kind of a father figure and might be one of the only people in Andrew Tate's life that talks like this. And the fact that David has misogynistic points of view might maybe gets him in the door to be able to help Andrew Tate in this way. And so, you know, what I'd be thinking is, I want to use what I can and struggle with the client to help them to be with me and be vulnerable without intellectualizing and pontificating, without resorting to the superior and arrogant and braggy, boastful modes. Just be with me and be in connection, and don't rely on your defenses to obscure any vulnerability. And just be with me, have eye contact, and just be close and real and authentic and in the moment and connected, and have it not be harmful to you because it was in the past. Let's have it be safe and feel good so that we can do this more, so that you can do it with others, so that you can trust yourself, so you don't have to rely on the defenses all the time, so that future sessions can have a little bit more time where I'm not entertaining your arrogant defenses, and we can, you know, continue this. And for a lot of therapists, I don't know the percentage, but even though they know to do this, they won't because they're afraid, or it's just easier not to. It'd be really easy with a client like Andrew Tate to just listen and to reflect and to occasionally confront, but be shut down and go, oh, you know, it's harder to do what David is doing right now. It takes a lot of effort. It's putting yourself out there. It takes a lot of neurons and heart to step into that role. Therapy is a struggle. It can be very hard. It can require a lot of us as therapists. You have to want it and need it. You have to feel the meaning and the purpose. You have to say, this is going to be hard for me and there's an easier path, but the purpose of my life is not that path. The purpose of my life is to actually try to help people, and I'm going to lean into this even though it's hard and it'll take a lot out of me. It's a risk as well. Maybe the client will reject me. You know, I'm a human too. I can be hurt. My feelings can be hurt by clients. I could be safer by just listening and reflecting and validating or whatever. So what David is doing is an example of very good therapy, even though he is apparently a massive misogynist, I've never seen that before. I've never seen a therapist that was that, even close to being that misogynistic, let alone a good therapist. I don't know if he's good, but someone who exhibits good therapy.
Yourself, be here with me and just see what happens.
But then what are we going to talk about?
We don't have to talk about anything. Doesn't it feel good to feel another man? Like just to feel the strength, like without the words, without that layer of thought and dialogue and discussion? Come back.
I'm thinking.
Come back. Don't think.
But I have to.
You don't have to.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And it's amazing that David has established, and Andrew Tate as well, a relationship that could handle this, because this is challenging for anybody, let alone someone like Andrew Tate. And even the metaphor that he's using of, you know, two men being in contact with each other, to a lot of people, particularly misogynistic men like Andrew Tate, that would be seen as some sort of indication of being gay, of course. And the fact that that didn't trigger Andrew Tate noticeably. So yeah, it's pretty intense and a good example, and it seems to be working. I've never had the opportunity to comment on this kind of, you know, for those of you who watch my channel, occasionally I will talk about what therapy is like, and occasionally I'll watch clips of therapy on reality TV or something. And by the way, I am planning on watching Showtime Couples Therapy. A lot of YouTube members were asking me to watch that, and I've been dying to watch it, so I'm looking forward to that. That'll be for members only, I think. But you might have seen me react to a lot of therapy and occasionally go, oh, you know, like with Couples Therapy on Showtime, I was able to talk about things that I am never able to talk about in other kinds of content reaction videos. And yet in all those moments that I have been provoked to talk about, I have only just scratched the surface regarding all the things that can and do happen in therapy, the kinds of experiences that I've had, you know, and I'm not unique, you know, that therapists have in therapy. I remember early in my career, I lamented that therapy was not seen by people outside. And of course, that's a good thing for confidentiality and safety and privacy. But there's so much drama that happens in therapy. But even if you saw it, it wouldn't feel dramatic. There's a possibility that for Andrew Tate right now, this is a very, very intense moment that he'll never forget, that will maybe even create some sort of high for him, some sort of neurological high for him for a week or something. Therapy can produce that for people. And so many things happen in therapy, you know, from second to second, from minute to minute, from hour to hour, week to week, month to month, year to year. There's so many little micro things that are happening and moves that you make and wonderful, glorious moments and intense moments and confusing moments and sad moments and angry moments and joyful moments and connected moments and self-discovery and eureka moments. And it's a very exciting experience, but I never get to talk about it because it's not presented to us very often. And when it is, it's just a glimpse. And I still can't necessarily convey to you what it's like unless you've been there before. But this is nice to be able to see this and to be able to comment on it because, you know, this is a pretty intense moment. And there are some therapists that do this all day long. And with every client or 90% of their clients, they will do this kind of work where it'll be very intense here and now, emotional, no intellectual, no talking about the past, no talking about the future. Just right here and now, what are you feeling? What's going on? What's going on in your body? How do you feel? How do you feel about me? What do you think about me? You know, just this very intense, you know, internal conversation about the therapeutic relationship. And I've done that kind of work, and it can be very healing to have a therapist that cares so much about you that they're willing to fight with you to connect with you.
Just be here. This is the place you get to when you're fighting. It feels good.
It's true, but there's a...
Doesn't it feel good?
Yes, but there's an action involved. Like, I can feel everything about the person I'm fighting, whether it's good or bad, and yeah. I can feel if I've hurt them or not.
Feel me.
I don't get to punch you, my friend.
You know, yeah.
If I had a session with a client like Andrew Tate, and it ended this way, I would consider it to be a huge success, even the reaching out of the handshake, that physical connection. I've had moments like that. I had a client once who was like Andrew Tate, not exactly, but in this camp. And I was really struggling with him over time and I was getting nowhere. And it was frustrating and annoying. And I began to hate this man. And I thought, I have one chance and I'm going to take it, which is to just lay it all on the line. I've tried everything else. I'm going to be brutally honest and authentic with him and real and aggressive and masculine. And the session lasted a long time. It was a lot longer than an hour. It might have even been a few hours. This is a long time ago, but my schedule was such that I could go long, and I was arguing with him. We were yelling at each other. He was, you know, very rageful with me. Yeah, I wasn't unglued, but I didn't hold anything back. And if he said something that was ridiculous, I'd say, "It's ridiculous. It's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard." You know, that kind of stuff. And because that was what I was thinking, and I thought maybe that would get through to him. I don't know. At the very least, I was thinking, for his family's sake, I think he needs to be told some of this shit. I don't care if he fires me. I feel like justice needs to be served. He needs to be told that he's ridiculous in a variety of ways and he's harming people in a variety of ways. And so I just let him have it, I think for a few hours. I don't know, it was a long session. And at the end of the session, things started to kind of, you know, wrap up and cool down. And I stood up and he stood up and he hugged me, or we hugged each other, or I can't remember who initiated. It wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't have initiated it, but so it must have been him. And then I reacted and we hugged and he relaxed and he became a long-term client. He was forever different in therapy after that. Every session after that, he would bawl his eyes out about halfway through the session. And all I had to say, I'm going to cry just thinking about it, but all I had to say to him was something along the lines of what's been happening in the session of just like, well, that must have been really scary for you. Or what are you feeling right now? You know, because he'd be pontificating and complaining or something. And all I'd have to do is just provoke some notion that he has emotions and that I care about it. And he would just start bawling. And he would always say, it makes me cry thinking about it. But he would always say, you do this to me every time, Dr. Honda, or something like that. And it was, you know, a very meaningful part of my life. And there's a lot of examples like that that I could tell you. And this has that feeling. It's two terribly misogynistic individuals, though. So, well, that does it for that series of episodes in which I reacted to this therapy session. I had no idea that it would provoke so much thought or things of me to say. I thought maybe I'd get one or two episodes out of it. Anyway, let me know what you think in the comments. And everyone, please take care of yourself because you deserve it, truly. You really, really do deserve it.